say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And I'd like to ask everybody to please help me give our speaker a warm welcome tonight. And this will be from Richmond.
Good evening. My name's Will. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, it's good to see you. It's the first time to Blue Ridge Speakers. I'm very grateful that Billy invited me up here, and I hope you can get something out what I've got to share tonight. I told Billy I've got one number in my head right now, and that's 231. That's God's road, evidently, at this time of year, and it was probably the prettiest night of the year driving up here. And when I was drinking, I wouldn't have even noticed that if I were lucky enough to have a car. I probably would have been on foot walking probably from University Avenue up to Rio Road, down the road to a place called Dunlora, which is now a fancy-dancy subdivision, but in those days, it was a old ramshackle, tumble-down house on 700 acres owned by Phil Phillips, the record guy. You know, he was our in absentia landlord, and we were on 700 acres on the Rivanna River, and I never really walked the land because I always wanted to. You know, I was one of those I'm gonna guys. You know, I would smoke a joint. You know, and I had three roommates. It was a federal house, and we had four bedrooms on the second floor, and we all had wood stoves, very hippies. And, you know, smoke a joint, drink a bunch of beers, and then I wouldn't go anywhere. I would just sort of sit there and read Kerouac or pass out or whatever. But I wasn't going to go anywhere as long as I was drinking. I wasn't one of those guys. I remember this talk I heard. And this is just underscores the vast experience of a panoply of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don Gates, he's dead now. He rose to probably as high a position in this country as anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was on the Appellate Court of California, and he went to the University of Oregon at Eugene and drank there, went to Harvard Law School, and never wrote a brief, but made a law review anyway, and, you know, got out coming smelling like a rose and burned mattresses, burned his family, not literally, but, you know, what we do, and ended up on the Appellate Court of California. I mean, most of the stuff he did in a blackout was, like, stunningly, you know, high achievement, you know, that I could probably never pull off sober. Unless I were called to, which I don't know that I have been, and I'm sitting here going, so how do I not drink, you know? Like I said, I'm glad to be here. Anybody under a year, please raise your hand. I just like to, great, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, welcome. If you're like me, perhaps this isn't your first trip to AA. If that's so, I have a couple of words. Please don't give up. I had to take every drink that I did in order to get here. And my sobriety date, by the way, is the 19th day of September, 1993. And as you can see, I lived to be gray, and I never thought that I would. I kind of surrendered to alcoholism when I was about 25. I got here when I was 28. And when I was 25, I was languishing in that wonderful city called Philadelphia. When W.C. Fields says, I'd rather be in Philadelphia, that's a sarcastic comment, by the way. And nothing wrong with Philadelphia. I love the city. My fiance's, you know, parents live there, but... I got to a place where I just didn't care anymore. It was just like, I can't not do this. I can't not do this and all the stuff that goes with it. I can't not do that. I've tried and tried and tried and tried and tried. The problem was is that, and I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous before this. This was around 91, 92, about a year before I got sober, the last mile, if you will. And I didn't understand. And a lot of folks who come here, this may be you, maybe not, but When we say that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that means powerless. It means that I can't not drink, you know? And that was abundantly clear when I woke up on September 18th, 1993 at 10:30 on a Saturday night, having drunk all but two fingers of a bottle of Jim Beam, a fifth, and I realized I didn't have to drink anymore and that AA was going to be my answer. It had been before, but I hadn't engaged you because I didn't understand what powerlessness was. I thought if I'm going to AA meetings and eventually getting a sponsor and eventually working the steps and at least drinking the coffee and socializing and maybe finding a girlfriend or something like that, then I'm doing AA. But that wasn't enough for me. And I didn't get that the longest I could go just not drinking and going to meetings was 6 weeks. That's as long as I ever lasted. I did that upon exiting a treatment center at the age of 20. And again, when I was 25, I lasted another 6 weeks in the wonderful city of Philadelphia, which sometimes I'd rather be in. 6 weeks of not drinking and going to meetings with a really strong impetus because I really mean it this time because the bender or the circumstances from the bender are such that, you know, I really got to not do that anymore. But as Clancy often says, you know, it's kind of like loading a spring. You know, whenever somebody says thou shalt not, it sounds like a great idea. Yeah, obviously I shalt not drink. You know, duh. You know, I'm just running away from hell. I mean, I know it's kicking my butt. But I don't get that eventually I'm going to do that again. I had to see that with stark raving clarity on the date that I mentioned. You know, I'm trying to get my life together and drink. I'm trying to get my life together and not drink. And guess what? Neither of them works for this guy. I just don't do well. When I stop drinking, it eventually feels like I just can't stand it anymore. And it shows up just like that. The first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just turning 20. It was Christmas of 1984, and I'd been in a treatment center for 6 weeks. There's nothing in my system. I am totally looking forward to being at my mother's home group as soon as I get off the plane at Kennedy Airport. I grew up in New York City, by the way. And so I get off the plane, and I go to my mother's home group, and Jimmy Gill comes up to me. He's 57 years old, and he's got the Irish cap on. He's just the sweetest guy in the world. And, hey, how you doing? I know that my mother sort of set him up to meet me, basically the bridge, the pontifex, you know, to make sure that I got a good start in AA. And I'm sure he would have been a fantastic sponsor, and at the very least, a good friend in AA. But I came here with the idea that I will shop around. And I didn't understand the urgency that this guy would need to not just do what I thought was okay. What I thought was okay never worked out. But I figured, well, I'm coming to meetings. I thought that's what that was. And I also thought that I should probably get sober with my comrades of my age. You know, I mean, I'm 20 years old. There's this old guy, 57. I'm almost 55 now. He's, you know, this old guy, you know, and that there's probably a generation gap. He's not going to understand me. I'm certainly not going to understand him. Old ideas that don't work. I never really had a father figure that I had in my life, not because my father didn't care. He was a grand fella, but I didn't reach out to him. So how would I know that my father was wise? You know, I basically felt like I was grown up enough to run my own life by the time I was 6 years old. You know, anybody have that? I'm fine. You know, I can figure it out. And I think my folks did, too. I think they thought they just didn't know what to do with me. You know, I would have these problems in school as a kid, and I, you know, lash out, and, you know, I cried a lot. I was a baby. You know, I have a funny last name, and, you know, people would pick on me, and I would, you know, and the strong like to prey on the weak, I think. I think it's an unfortunate human trait, and there's always a few who will do that. And I took that to heart. And from a very early age, after kindergarten, I felt like I could put sandwich boards on my body, not saying the end is nigh, but look what they've done to me. You know, and I felt like that from the age of six. You know, that's crazy. But I also know, I mean, looking back and growing up, I also knew that there were people who really wanted the best for me and my friends in school and the kids in the neighborhood. I mean, we were being raised in what I consider to be one of the nicest communities in America. Okay? I mean, we had it all. We not only had three hots and a cot and good schools to go to, but we had parents that really looked out for us. And they were cool. I mean, for those days, they were pretty cool. And, you know, so, but I was wired together to do what I thought I wanted to do. And I had this old idea that parents, while I know that they want what's best for me, that's not what I want for me. So they look like the enemy in a way. So all adults, by extension, look like the enemy. They look like an impediment to my freedom. Don't do this and don't do that. Don't drink in school. Don't smoke cigarettes. Well, you're smoking cigarettes. Well, you can do that when you're 18, you know. But I just gravitated to whatever I thought was going to make me fit in. And I remember seeing the Bad News Bears and the guy with the motorcycle, and he was like 12 or something, and he was smoking cigarettes. So I thought that that was what I'm supposed to do. So I started smoking cigarettes. So at the age of 12, I'm starting to smoke. I smoked for 33 years, you know. 33 years I'm smoking, you know, because I saw some guy on TV, you know, and I know that it's bad. So knowledge has got nothing to do with how my life is going to go. It just doesn't. And I developed the belief system very early on that I can handle whatever's coming at me. And if I can't, then I just won't do it. And if I can't do it right away or pretty quickly, I just won't bother. It is that horrible, horrible pride that they talk about. You know, how pride leads the list of the seven deadly sins. I understand that to mean that I've got to be really, really good in your eyes so that you not just like me, but you respect me and maybe even fear me. You know, but I need to know that I am somehow better than you. I don't know where that idea came from, because it sure as heck didn't come from my parents. You know, my father was a very, very kind, gentle person, and he lived in what we know in Alcoholics Anonymous as the level playing field of serenity. You know, he didn't just automatically accept things on a 10 step, but he was very, very cool. He endured me and a lot of shenanigans for a lot of years. And, you know, and I did okay in school until I got to my father's alma mater, you know, and I'm really psyched to be able to go to this fantastic school. But I also have the arrogance that says I won't go to the first class. I'll just go to the second class. Well, that, you know, I won't go the first day. I'll go the next day, because I got so drunk during orientation that carried into when classes started. And, that carried into the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. I mean, with a temerity that surprises even me today, I got all the way to Thanksgiving vacation that Tuesday, going to the dean's office and saying, I haven't done anything this semester. I'll do better next semester. And she said, well, you're not coming back next semester if you haven't done anything. I was crestfallen and more than a little surprised, because I didn't think very much about my abilities and stuff, which is part of the reason I didn't show up at class, which was sort of weird. I mean, you know, you show up at class, you learn stuff, evidently, but I thought that I had to know it before I went in. And I was hanging around with kids in the dorms that were so much freaking smarter. I shouldn't have gone to that school. I just wasn't really qualified to begin with. I'm a dummy. But I mean, these kids were so freaking smart that if I show up in their class, they're going to know that I'm a fraud and I shouldn't be here. So that was a big reason that I had to go, like, onto University Avenue and do some of this before I go to class. Well, Anybody who's done a little bit of this who's here tonight probably knows that if you do a little bit of this, you're going to continue to do a lot more of that. So, you know, Cabell Hall is like a quarter, half a mile away, and I'm not going there now because I'm half in the bag. They're going to know. So I couldn't win for trying. You know, it just wasn't going to happen for me. I was an absolute nervous wreck. By that time, I had pledged a fraternity, and so I lived in that fraternity for that next semester where I was supposed to go to PVCC. I went to the first class there. I thought that I would have some way to get out there. Well, it was really cold that winter, and I made no plans to get out to PVCC from Madison Lane, which is right pretty much at the university. And so I didn't go to class, and then my parents came down and visited in April, and I had to tell them, you know, I haven't been doing anything. This after like 9 Molson Ales, you know, before they came to pick me up for dinner. So that was really a red letter day. And before they even got to take me to dinner, I put my hand in frustration, and just me being the nervous wreck guy. I mean, I'm 19 years old, and I'm not getting what I need out of alcohol anymore like I want to. It's just, it's got me by the stones. And I put my hand through a French door on the porch of the fraternity house and cracked my hand open, and they took me down to student health. And, you know, they were just like, do you want to go to the hospital for alcoholism treatment? I'm just like, no. What's the matter with you? I got this. And then I went to summer school and lived in the fraternity, and by the skin of my teeth made it back in to the university. I think my father had something to do with that. I'm sure that he wrote a letter to somebody. Anyway, they were happy to take our out-of-state money, and I came back in, and I lasted about 3 weeks going to class, and that's all that I could muster. And I was back doing exactly the same thing, and ended up in a treatment center, and I came back out, like I said, 6 weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous with no Jimmy Gill, no follow-up on that. And that's what my alcoholism looked like. You know, I just cannot get it together. I am not okay. I'm not okay drinking, and I'm not okay not drinking. The problem with alcoholism for me is that drinking looks like hope to me. It always looks like hope. I know it's not going to be great, but it's going to be better than not drinking. I can tell you that, you know. And so there were times too, and I lived in Seville for a while. I lived, where the hell was I? Yeah, I lived there for like 3.5 years delivering pizza to the guys that I'd gone to school with. Talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. They're going through the E school and the A school, and they're going through the freaking business school, and they're going to come out smelling like roses, and they're giving me good tips, and I think I'm doing real well. You know, I'm running the Grand Prix Le Mans every night from 5 p.m. to 2 a.m., and then drinking as many pitchers as I can possibly get down my throat at the end of my shift, and then going out and polishing myself off and sleeping until like noon. And at one point, I was like, I've got to rein it in here. So I got 3 jobs. So now I'm delivering pizza from 5 till 2 in the morning. I get about 3 hours of sleep. Then I deliver the Daily Progress over to off of Pantops Mountain, which is like 20 miles from where I live in Ivy. And then at 7:30 in the morning, I'm doing prep chefing back in Ivy, and a mile from where I live, and I'm there till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Get another 2 hours of sleep, and then go back to town and deliver pizza. That lasted for about 6 months. I was crazy. You know what that looks like. So, yeah, and I never saved a dime. And the other pitiful thing was I would call my father asking for money. And by the time I got to Philadelphia in around 1990-91, I would call him up on a payphone collect because I couldn't even pay my phone bill. And he'd be like, how much do you need? And one time, this should tell you what kind of a guy I was, all right? I would call him up. He'd know that I'd been to AA before. So on one, I had a flash of genius. I called him up. I was like, how can I really get some serious money? Now, serious money meant like $1,000 to me in those days. That was like big money. You know, if I had $1,000, that would last me a good little while, you know, doing what I do. And I called him up and I said, Dad, I'm so sorry I haven't called you. And it had been about 3 weeks since I'd called him. I said, Dad, I haven't called you for a while. I'm in AA again. I've been in AA for 3 weeks. And my sponsor didn't think that it would be a particularly good idea for me to call you guys. It might be sort of a trigger for my alcoholism, not because of you guys, but because I'm so ashamed of what I've done to you and Mom. And I'm on the accelerated program, though. And I'm on step 9. And that's where we make amends. And my next step in that step is to pay back some money. And there's this guy that I owe, like, I just came up with a number, $5,000 to. And he sells things for profits that I sometimes use. My father, of course, just wants to protect his child. That's all he ever wanted to do. I'm an only child. When the prince arrived, it's like I'm the freaking center of the universe to my parents and to me, but most especially to me. No regard for them, and unless it was convenient. And so basically, I emotionally extorted my father over the phone because I know when I say $5,000 to Claudio, he's going to think that if I don't get that money, if this is true, then I could be like filleted on the streets of Philadelphia, okay? And so he had that stuff wired to my account in about an hour, okay? And I felt about this big, but I got what I wanted. And when I got sober, I brought this thing up to him and I said, I've not been a good son, and this is one of the ways that I was. And he said, you know what? I was 99.44% sure that that was BS too. But there was that 0.56%, you know, chance that maybe you were telling the truth, because I couldn't stand the idea of losing my son to a gosh darn drug deal. All right? So that's the kind of stand-up guy my father was. He couldn't see necessarily the truth from the false because I didn't give him any reason to see the truth from the false around me. But I was nothing but a disappointment. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, September 19th is my sobriety date. It was 10:30 on a Saturday night when I called Alcoholics Anonymous from Richmond. I had tried to get my life together one more time, and I wanted to go to school one more time. And it had been 8.5 years since I'd been in school, and I'd had bunches of jobs and this and that and yada, yada, yada. And we'll just skip all that. None of it worked long term, obviously, or I wouldn't have moved to Richmond. I really want to get my life together, and I should go to school. I wasn't entirely ready to stop drinking. Moved to Richmond in May. Got an apartment sight unseen that my heroin-addicted ex-running buddy found for me, because I can't even stay in Richmond long enough to actually go look for the apartment that I came down there to look for. And my father had to co-sign the lease. I mean, this is what I'm down to. But the future looks good. So I get to, you know, it's 5 months later, and I painted that summer and went to school, and I did pretty well. I didn't drink so much, but my heroin-addicted buddy and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, this is just part of my story. I'll worship anything that gets this to quiet down. I could get some of that non-habit-forming powder that people seem to be so enamored of these days at the end of every day, because we had per diems, and I could get $100 and I could get some of that, and I could go to class and I could show up, you know. But I could only do that a couple times a week before I was, like, really uncomfortable. And I also told my dad, and this was sort of like pre-recovery, I promise, you know, and it really was kind of sincere. When I got down there, I said, my dad gave me $125 a week allowance out of this trust that my grandmother had left me for education. And I said, no matter what I say, there's no reason in the world why I should need another any more than $125 for expenses, for food and, you know, clothing and books and that kind of thing. And so he kind of got that, and Anyway, so 5 months, and I get to a place where I can't stand me anymore. The Monday before that Saturday, a guy came by that I'd been painting with, and evidently he's the only social crack user in Richmond. And he came by, and he said, he knocked on my door. I don't know why he does this, but he knocked on the door. He said, "You want to get high?" And I thought he was just going to fire up a joint, you know. And I've got to meet the Witch of Eastwick for European history at 8 o'clock in the morning, all right? Great professor, but man, you got to sit in that front row, and she was really tough, you know. And so it's Monday night. He comes in, he fires up this rock of cocaine that'll just blow your head off. I said, "Great, you know, you got any more of that, or where can we get some more of that?" He's like, "Oh no, some guy just gave this to me today." I was like, "That's all?" It's like, "Yeah." And I don't have any booze in the house or anything like that. And so he leaves, whatever. I don't think I said anything mean to him, but I was like, well, don't start something you can't finish, right? I mean, so I'm not going to go into the neighborhoods where you need to do that, and I wouldn't know where to go anyway because I'm pretty new in Richmond. And I left Philadelphia so I'd get away from all that stuff anyway. And but I did know how to get booze on a Saturday. You just go to the 7-Eleven and you buy two bottles of Ernest & Julio's Finest, the purple and the white variety. And I came home and, like, slammed those down like they were water. Now it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm, like, sorted kind of drunk, but also very like this. And I've got, like, 3-4 hours to, like, get a little bit of shut-eye. And I know this is not going to go well because, see, I had promised myself that I wouldn't drink during the week. And by and large, aside from, you know, smoking a little weed here and there with some people, I'd pretty much kept to that. And I'd become a weekend warrior by the skin of my teeth for about 5 months. But I'd broken that promise to myself. You know, I'd drunk on a weekday, started with the stupid drugs and blah, blah, blah. I remember being so hangdog and very scared all week during classes. And I made all my classes. Now, before, I was very psyched to be back at school, learning and doing the deal and making something of myself, yada, yada, yada. And now I'm like, it just, my spirit just felt so bad. I was making my classes, but my spirit was like shot. And what do you do on a Saturday if you've been trying to get your mojo back academically and spiritually or psychically or emotionally, whatever? And I've been in Cabell Library all day at VCU. And they closed the library about 5 o'clock in those days. What do you do if you're a damn Yankee in the holy city of Richmond, Virginia, where the war isn't over yet? This is the mind that I brought to Virginia people. It's better now, but... Well, if you're me, it doesn't matter whether you're in Richmond or Detroit, Michigan. You go to the ABC store at Broad and Mulberry and you cuff another jug. That's what you do. It's Saturday night, for God's sakes. And there's nobody around to tell me what to do. And there's no girlfriend. And there's no parents. And there's no dean of students breathing down my neck. And on paper, everything is okay up to this point. But that's what happened. I got down to the two fingers left. And it occurred to me that if I continue to drink, I'm going to die. And I had another moment of clarity, which I'd never had, and I certainly didn't have on the phone with my father saying, extorting him for $5,000, is that I'd been on this earth for 28 years, and my parents loved me in spite of tons of garbage that I had thrown their way, and all the other people who had tried to love me, and I couldn't love them back, and I couldn't maintain anything like a relationship with anybody for any length of time that was anything like authentic. And I couldn't stand that guy 1 second longer. And my parents deserved a hell of a lot better than that, you know. And this has got to stop. And I know that AA is the answer. So my second step wasn't, I came to believe that God could restore me to sanity. I came to believe that what worked for my mother and it worked for my father's golf partner, Peck, and a whole bunch of other people that I'd met over the years would work for me. I knew that I hadn't done it. I knew that I hadn't come here, gotten a sponsor, worked the steps, had a home group, and be engaged with you. You know, and I am not a joiner, but I was perfectly willing to hang out with you guys. It meant that I didn't have to be me anymore. And that's exactly what happened. And I've been here ever since. Okay? So I needed a really good reason beyond just, I'm going to die. I don't want to die knowing that my parents are going to be left with a disappointment of 28 years. That's absolutely untenable to me. And I was graced with that realization. And so I came to you. I called up the number for Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me 20 minutes to find the number. A guy named Chuck answered. He says, "Hi, I'm Chuck. How can I help you?" I said, "Is this AA?" And I realized that they had the same thing called Phone Watch in Richmond. It was Nightbook in New York. Is that when the office of Alcoholics Anonymous locally shuts down for the day, they patch it in. I think it was Star 72. You know, they patch it into any volunteer that would be willing to take calls on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he says, "Well, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. How can I help you?" I said, "Where are the meetings?" Now, I had another moment of clarity, which also was probably the most selfless thought that I'd ever had in my entire life. And that was, I'd better find out where the meeting is tomorrow as soon as possible, go to it, and get off the phone. Because there might be somebody behind me who, if they can't get through because I'm drunk and dialing and blah, 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 blah. You ever drink and dial and go blah for like an hour? Yeah, I used to do that too. I outgrew that about 3 years before I stopped drinking, but as I said, I didn't have a phone anymore, so there you go. So I better get off the phone so that if there's somebody behind me, their lives can be saved too. So in spirit, I was already a member of you before I went to the meeting at 11 o'clock the next morning at the old Stewart Circle Hospital. And I can look around that room right now with my mind's eye and remember just about everybody who was there. I remember that almost as well as I remember my first drink at the age of 12. Yeah. My first drink, by the way, was terrific. Was your first drink terrific? Mm-hmm. Raise your hand if your first drinking experience was pretty darn terrific. Raise your hand if it eventually got really terrific. Okay. All right. A little audience participation. It was terrific. Oh, who would want to, like, not sign up for terrific? Even if there's a little bit of minor bumps and bruises along. So I went to that meeting, and Basil was there, and Scott was there, and three other guys named Scott were there, and Big Mama Jane, and Connie Johnston, and a whole bunch of other people. And I don't know what the hell they were talking about, but I remember picking up a white chip, and I remember getting the numbers of every single guy in that room. I remember that from last time. Get the numbers of all the guys in the room. Call them. Well, I got the numbers of the guys in the room, and I went to meetings all the time, and you were the safest place in the world. I found it very difficult to show my face any other place besides the hallowed halls of academia and Alcoholics Anonymous. It was very hard for me to go to the grocery store because they'll know. I'm stone cold sober, but I'm me, remember, and they'll know. They'll know. I don't know what they'll know, but they'll know that if you get too close to me, you're going to get that broken sewer line stuck all over you. That's what I brought to you. Along with that, we bring what the Big Book calls bravado. That just means I'm scared to death. I am absolutely scared to death of you, and I don't know how to tell you that. Fear ruled my life for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was like water unto the fish. All right. I didn't even know how scared I was until I was probably 5 or 6 years sober. You know, I had all kinds of stuff. And I came here. I don't know. I think I burned out my IQ at a Grateful Dead concert in like 1986. Saw those guys a lot, by the way. Took up a lot of my time and energy. Had a great time doing it, too, until I didn't. But, you know, I had two brain cells, you know, saying goodbye to each other when I got here, but I still thought that I had a pretty good mind, but I didn't have the kind of mind that knew how to, like, relate to you very well. And I certainly can't tell you what a dismal failure I was, even though I was hearing dismal failures talking about their dismal failures all the time in AA. I thought for some reason I had to come here already knowing stuff. So you had to crack me open repeatedly for years here. Because I thought that my intellectual capacity would enable me to have a spiritual experience. Well, it doesn't. Now, it doesn't mean that I didn't take the steps. I just didn't take the steps with the kind of depth that they need to be taken But we take them and take them and take them and take them. It's kind of like chipping away at a big chunk of marble until David shows up. And that's what Michelangelo did, right? How did you make David? I chipped away everything that wasn't David. Well, that's exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we show up like covered over with all this stuff. They call them old ideas. I need to do this, and I need to do that, and I need $1,000, and I need to get her back, and I need to get this job, blah, 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 blah. And none of that matters, which doesn't sound particularly sexy. It really doesn't. Only God can restore you to sanity. Only a higher power. Oh, my goodness. You know, my mind thinks that I'm going to be a monk, you know, never having sex again and never having any money, both of which I worshipped, okay? I didn't get sober and just lose my interest in girls. I didn't get sober and lose my interest in making a big pile of sweaty money, you know? And I thought that those things would make my life whole. So I went after those things with everything that I did was basically about those things to fill this thing in here that I was trying to really have a spiritual experience, but I couldn't detach myself from the things of the world that I thought that I needed to be okay. But the most important thing that I needed was your approval, first and foremost. If I couldn't get your approval, I hated you. I'm not like some people, like they're just big and bad and they'll never admit that they're wrong and, you know, what's the matter with China or anything like that. I'm the guy who is so scared of his own shadow that I don't think that for me to show up as I am is enough. You know, that's what I brought to you. It's a lie. It's not true. But that's what I believed. And as long as I believed that, I was still playing God. Even though I said this third step prayer, I surrender my life to you, God. Build with me and do with me as you will. But I didn't really mean it because I knew that if I really meant it, if he really answered that prayer, I would be sent to Mexico, to the Sonora Desert, to a shack, you know, with an empty light bulb, learning how to speak Spanish real well so that I can 12-step, you know, the people in the Sonora Desert and never have sex and never have any money. That doesn't look good to me. I thought I was going to end up being like that guy. You know, if I really surrendered to God. I told my sponsor that when I was 5 years sober. He said, Will, if you really turned your will and your life over to the care of God and he did send you to Mexico to do all those things, you'd be happier than you are now. Because I was lamenting everything in my life. Every 6 months, it was another tragedy. I was walking into walls all over in sobriety. And that's just kind of my story, you know. But I never left you. I never believed that leaving Alcoholics Anonymous or that drinking would be a good idea. I sponsored guys. I don't know why they listened to anything that I had to say. But it does say in the big book, and I'm quoting, "Surely you will find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you will have to offer." That's a nice left-handed compliment. But it's also true. And Bill bore that out every day that he was sober. Sometimes Bill was on top of the world, and sometimes he felt like a pile of garbage. And I'm sure we've all had that experience, you know, with our wives, with our bosses, with even in AA. I sometimes felt like I don't even, hi, pig. I sometimes don't even feel like I belonged here. You know, I'm too sick for AA, or I'm too sick to get the whole God piece. And I'm sponsoring guys, and they're like passing me on the spiritual superhighway. By this time, I've graduated school with high honors, and I've got a job, and I'm making a lot of freaking money, and I'm walking into walls. I am absolutely sleepwalking. I don't know that. I just want what other people are saying, because all I'm hearing from the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous is something that some people call the prosperity gospel. If you do the steps, God will reward you beyond your wildest dreams. And what I saw was they got the wife, they got the house, they got rid of the bankruptcy, and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And I'm like, I want all those things. I'll do that. And I would go back through the steps again, and nothing would happen, and I would just get sick again. But it wasn't – so I was actually using the steps so that I could manage my life. Just wanted to share that with you in case that's what you've been trying to do. In my case, that doesn't work because I didn't really believe that God could restore me to sanity, which is really what I really, that's what I really want. That's what alcohol did when it worked. Remember when alcohol worked? I feel sane. Like Billy and I were talking about before the meeting. That just puts me together. That just rubs off all the rough edges. You know, that turns me from a bunch of Edward Scissorhand knives to a nice globular being that is just kind and gentle. You know, until I'm not anymore. So I stayed very, very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a lot of service positions. I was GSR for two different groups. I was DCM out in Nevada. But here's how crazy I could get. When I was 8 years sober, 9 years sober, I broke up with a gal. I didn't break up with her. She broke up with me. It just wasn't working out, and I kind of knew it. And I was, once again, crestfallen. Not the first time this had happened. I was so unhappy that I moved all the way to Las Vegas, Nevada. I thought I rationalized it by saying, well, I'm a massage therapist now. I wasn't making any money as a massage therapist. I was making money as a real estate agent. But I wanted to go out there and be a massage therapist and live the peace, love, tofu life. But I didn't think that business plan through very well. Not only that, but I wasn't running to an opportunity. I was running away from, you know, the embarrassment that I had incurred from all of this drama that I created. Okay, so I get out there, and I'm just like, I'm going to be cool out there. But that was a geographic. And most people do get their geographics done while they're drinking. I had to do geographics in sobriety. That's how nuts I am. And they gave me a nice going away party. But everybody knew what I was doing. And I knew that they knew what I was doing, which was really crazy. And I'm out there, and I'm not making any money as a massage therapist. Here's how bad that business plan is. Anybody have been to Las Vegas? You kind of know what it's about, right? Like hookers and drugs and gambling. I don't care that they have roller coasters. It's about hookers, drugs, and gambling. All right? And excuse me if you're from Las Vegas and you resent that. Talk to your sponsor. But massage therapy in the phone book, remember phone books, is like this thick out of a phone book that's like this thick. And it's not really massage therapy. So, I mean, come on. You know, it's kind of dodgy. You know, I'm the real deal. I'm just doing therapeutic massage, but that's not what they're talking about. And I'm not going to, like, convince them. You know, I'm not the guy. I'm not that guy. But what I did do out there was get in front of people who were really, really messed up from a lot of drinking and drugs. Because if you make it all the way out to Las Vegas on a geographic drinking, you've gone a long way down the pipe, pal. You know, and there are people beat up from the feet up like I never had met before. And they were coming back for more drinking, drugs, and then you could my constitution couldn't handle that for a day, let alone the kind of years they were putting together out there. No teeth and freaking, but they all had cell phones. It was amazing. And I show up at the Westcare Foundation every day with Bob and Sheldon and George and Larry and Deborah. And we all showed up at noon every day and we'd pitch. And every once in a while we'd get one. But it helped us. You know, it helped us. It helped reinforce who we are and where we could be. And every once in a while we'd get one. So, and I was doing all that kind of stuff. But see, I just want to fit in. And I'm doing all this stuff in AA to fit in, but I'm still not really surrendered. Well, an amends went really wrong. And anybody know the story of Jonah and the whale in the Bible? Okay, this guy, he God tells him to go to Nineveh to carry the message of AA or whatever, right? And he doesn't want to do it. And he gets on this ship and he goes all the way to like Spain or something, right? All the way across the Mediterranean. On the way, you know, the people on board realize that he's there for the wrong reasons. And they cast him off the ship. And he gets eaten by the whale and he gets spit up on the seashore. He's like, okay, now I'll go to Nineveh. Well, that's kind of my story. At 12 years of sobriety, after 3 years in Las Vegas, God had other plans, okay? And it was kind of sad because my plan was to go, I was going to leave anyway and go take care of my mother in Florida because she was dying, okay? She was in her last days. And I ended up, at 12 years of sobriety, under indictment. Indictment! Because Virginia is the only, is one of seven states in the country that doesn't, that has no statute of limitations on felony. So I'm under indictment. Now I'm coming here and I'm like, I'm going to die. You know? And I'm trying to do AA here. And my buddy Alex, who's I will never be able to pay enough forward what Alex did for me. Some of you have met him. He let me live in his house and go to AA meetings, and he sponsored me again. He picked up the ball where I left off in Las Vegas. And I'm just like pulling my hair out and going through this horrible situation. And I mean, it was nuts. I mean, even today, it's hard to believe that it even happened. But during that time period, before I had to face the music and courts, and I eventually pled out because I was so psychologically beaten, I was like, I don't even want to deal with this anymore. So I took a plea. And during that time, during that 10 months, one of the people that I was hanging out with was a guy named Ed McGuire. He's gone now. He had cancer, and he was getting the silver bag, the big one that really kicks your ass. And I was taking him to chemo like twice a week. And after one day with Ed, and he was just the sweetest guy in the world. He had a spirit the size of Montana. And I came back from hanging out with him at chemo one day, and I said to Alex, you know, for all that's going on in my life right now and the way Ed's doing, I would trade places with Ed in a minute. Basically saying, I don't care. I'll just take me out, because the pain of this is just way too much. It's killing my mother. It's killing me. I can't get to my mother because she's in Florida and I can't leave the state. And he said something that made me want to just take an axe to his head. He said, you might want to reconsider your position. Well, you can't get violent with people, and I'm not a violent guy anyway, but I mean, you can't get violent with people who are kind to you. Yeah. It's a good weapon, by the way, kindness. So I molded over, and yeah, I'm not going to, you know, and it's a dumb wish anyway. You can't wish your destiny, and I understood enough about the way stuff worked in life that you just kind of have to slog through it, even though I didn't want to. So I went through all this stuff, and I hung out in a gated community for 6 months and came out, and I was still very, very frightened. And my life, basically I got dinged into a life that I'd never expected and that I wasn't really raised to deal with. I mean, quite frankly, I don't really do jail all that well, you know. And even after it was over, I just felt so wounded around all that. It was, I don't know if PTSD, but psychologically I was like really messed up. But I met a really good guy in there, and he guided my spiritual reading. And he was from here in Charlottesville, and I got in front of some people that the Big Book recognizes, some church folks, you know, and that's been very good. So the symbiosis between, you know, being quick to see where religious people are right, and also, you know, the AA program helped me to get more infused. And Billy and I too were talking about the things that we have suffered in our lives have enabled us to ultimately have way more compassion than we ever thought possible for other people. And so while I'm not thrilled that all that went down, I don't think that I could have been the guy that I always wanted to be unless that had happened. I just don't understand how that could have happened any other way. In any case, that's the way it happened. And I got in front of, when I was 17 years sober, this was 2010, 2001, I got in front of, part of my faith is confession, also bingo, if you want to stop by on Wednesday nights. I got in front of Monsignor Lane one day, and, you know, I was still very frightened and not the guy that I really wanted to be, and I knew that God was in his heaven and that he cared about us all very, very much, but I was still really, really stuck. And I remember Bob Azzanz talking about how step two was elusive for him at 7-8 years of sobriety, and he said, I believe for you, but not for me. And I was back in that place. I had been in that place periodically, and I had been in that place now for about 18 months, 19 months. It was a tough place to be. And I didn't think I was ever going to get better. And I went through my litany of stuff for the week, kind of like we do with our sponsors, you know, 10-step inventory type stuff, except, you know, with the church's rubric of, like, this is what I've done, this is what I failed to do. It's basically the same deal. And I get about halfway through it, and he'd been my confessor for about 6 months at that point. And he said, about halfway through my litany of stuff for the week, he said, "Let me stop you just for a second. Let me ask you something, Will." I said, what is it, Father?" He said, "Do you have hope?" And I said, "Well, while I'm in confession and being honest before you and God, no, now that you ask." He says, "I know. That's why I asked the question." He said, "You can go through the rest of the litany of your stuff, and I'll give you absolution. But for your penance," and I know that I'm doing this backwards, he said, "I want you to go and pray for hope." And I said, "Well, I've got something else to confess. It just occurred to me that I am reluctant to pray for the one thing that you and I and God all know that I need." If you've ever been there, I recommend the same penance that he offered me. It was to pray for hope. I did not leave there. Normally I would leave and the other priest would give me, like, you know, a passage from Ephesians to read and pray on that, say a few Hail Marys, and off we go. Well, that day he gave me the most difficult penance that I ever had to consider, to pray for something that I didn't believe that I deserved or could happen to me. And nobody had ever asked me that question before. "Do you have hope?" "No, I don't." "I know. Go pray for hope." 3 days later, I'm making a bowl of spaghetti, and it occurred to me that I absolutely love Monsignor Lane, and I know that he loves me, and I know that you and Alcoholics Anonymous love me, and I want to love you better, and I want to love God better. And while I don't really necessarily, with all the fervor of the newly converted, believe what I'm about to do, I got down on my knees as the water was boiling, and I said, sort of Sarah Palin-y, I said, "If you could send some of that Hopi stuff down, that would be great." I said it just like that, out loud in my kitchen with nobody around. And that was about the most honest prayer I'd ever said in my entire life. See, the prayers aren't words. The prayers are cries of the heart, and they are to help us. God doesn't need them. I do. And what I needed to do that day was to pray for what I knew that Monsignor and God and I all know that I needed. And before I even got to anything like an amen, I could just feel the weight of the world just coming off of me like it had never come off of me before. And I never have had a dark day of doubt ever again since that day. I've had my moments. I get upset with Laura and problems at work and yada, yada, yada. And certainly people drive way too slow in Charlottesville. But aside from that, you know, I know that things will never be the same. And it took me 17 years to get there. All right? So if you don't have hope, if you ask yourself, "Do I, Jake, do I, Tim, do I have hope?" And then the answer is no, then you can pray for that, and he will give you that. This is my experience. I never thought, too, that a lot of the experiences that I've had in my life, from my drinking or from just being slogging it out in chasing a spiritual life in Alcoholics Anonymous, would benefit anybody, but they have benefited way more people than I ever thought it would ever be. It took a little while for those loaves to sort of bake in my oven before God presented me with people with whom I could be the bridge builder. But such has been the grace. And so that's why I always say, if you've been having trouble, don't give up, because life is incredibly precious. And it's a freaking kick in the pants, man. It's a good deal. So one day, shortly after that, I was I'd been doing some stuff with this gal. She had lost her husband about 2 years before. And we were doing some stuff with Caritas back when we were a lot more visible with Caritas's churches in Richmond, helping the homeless. And I'd been ushering with her, too. I wasn't making moves on her because where I come from, you don't make moves on widows. You just don't. They're consecrated widows, for God's sakes. They're not getting remarried. I mean, some of them do, but, I mean, they don't, right? That was my idea. And so, but we got to be friends, and we were arguing about some hot-button issue in the church. The church has a lot of hot-button issues, I'm sure you're familiar with. And I just wanted to go to yoga. And mass is over, da-da-da-da, we're cleaning up. And I was like, We can talk about this later, Laura. I'm going to. This was a pause moment for me. I'm a guy who was born without a filter, and here's a friend of mine, a woman friend, which I rarely had in my life, and we're just slogging it out and blah 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 blah. And by the way, we're both Irish, and the Irish creed is you got to fight till you win or fight till you die. That's why there are so few Irish left, because we all kind of killed each other. And 6:57, I'm going to wrap this up. She said, as I'm walking down the stairs, I got one more question for you. I don't know if you're in a relationship or what, but would you like to have dinner sometime? I mean, I'm just at your throat, and you're asking me to dinner. Well, now she's my fiancée. We're getting married soon. Isn't that cool? Yeah. Oh, it's nice to end on a good note.